All right, so let's start out on our issues. And oddly enough, the first one is mine. Suppose it turns out that caloric restriction works as well in humans as in rats, resulting in a 50% increase in lifespan. Is a parent who doesn't deliberately keep his child very thin guilty of child neglect? And I should say, for those not familiar with the literature, there is some evidence that for at least some mammalian species, if you give them a diet which just barely meets the requirements, so to speak, the sort of diet that would leave a human being thin but reasonably healthy, it sizably lengthens lifespan. So, maybe too late for me, I don't know. And some of you, if you really want to live long, you might want to think about being experimental animals yourself and seeing whether if you, you know, cut down, made sure you had all the necessary vitamins and minerals, but kept your calorie to what would just barely keep you going, if that would be a sensible strategy. But anyway, suppose it's true. Is that then child neglect? Is that grounds for taking children away? Yeah?
Would the children, like, just barely be subsisting? Basically, like, they're the skinny little kids.
They're what?
They're just skinny kids.
Yeah, they'd be skinny, but not unhealthily skinny. That's the theory of what you're doing. They do look nice. Yeah?
Similar thing, I followed that story about the rats. I actually followed a couple who actually prescribed it at a method of, like, you know, barely limiting caloric intake, like 1,500 or something a day. And what they felt that the biggest setback was that it killed their libido, it set back their moods, and it was, you know, they may put it through living longer, but
not enjoying it.
Yeah, not enjoying it. Yeah. Maybe it might not be any better. Maybe you want your kids to enjoy a full life, not just a long life.
In fact, our case is related to this, not in the U.S., but in England. I was checking, and there are some news stories where local authorities have apparently taken children away from their parents for being too obese. And so it's a different version, but it's the same argument of saying that the diet the parents feed them is one which is bad for them. And apparently, that is how common this is, whether they stayed kept away, I don't know, but I think I saw references when I was Googling for it to three different cases in England where whoever their equivalent of Child Protective Services took children away because they were too heavy. And so it's not absurd. I'm not sure if it happened in the U.S. or not. I think probably a little less likely.
In the U.S., it's happened. So I had to do this for one course. In the U.S., it's happened a few times. It's really hard to take a kid away from that. You have children that are hospitalized and at 10 years old weighing over 300 or 400 pounds and still are going back to their parents. So it's very difficult to take away for feeding them in problems. Yeah. Or at least on the too much food.
Right. If you're teaching the wrong religion, maybe it's easier. I followed the FLDS case in Texas and was rather unhappy with that, although in that case the courts eventually insisted that the kids had to be given back and there was no legal grounds for holding them. So I guess in a sense part of it is going to be public perception, which is why what I'm describing isn't really going to happen. But in terms of the legal status, once it's really well established, then you could say, well, if there is a right way of treating kids. I mean, in a sense, I was really thinking less of the obesity originally than of the question of Christian Science parents who don't give their kids antibiotics or have them vaccinated or things of that sort. And I think that is going to vary according to society, how willing that I think the U.S. probably goes farther than England, I would guess, in saying that the parents get to decide what's in the interest of their kids. All right, I think our next one is... another David, I think. Is that right? D.E. is David Aramia.
Yeah.
Not here. Recognize the name, but it says something in. Oh, he's supposed to be over there, according to the seating chart. All right, well, we'll have to do without him. That's too bad, because he had a number of interesting ones. Let me then read it for him. After all, one David should be able to substitute for another. You do realize, by the way, that if you want a job at Santa Clara University Law School at your Mayo, you have to be named David. I mean, we do have this policy that you only hire David. I don't know if DeVitas would do. assume scientists make an incredible breakthrough that makes it possible to extend one's life indefinitely. Should existing life estates, originally created before this breakthrough, where the original owner had no way of foreseeing that the life tenant may live so long, be capped at some number of years, 100, 150, or should the life tenant still own the land until his death? And it struck me as a very interesting, quite general issue. That is, you have contracts. The contracts are made on some set of factual assumptions, often unstated, the way people are used to the world being. The terms of the contracts are nominally the same, but are in effect sharply changed by some change in the world. How do you handle it? Anybody think of any real examples?
Yeah. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind for me is that there's contract. You can't contract to the way you want. So if I live on an estate and I want to create a life estate so my kids take it when I die, then there's no reason that they should get it before I die and I'm homeless. You know?
But what about, I was thinking not of that case. Suppose I rent you a house, and for some reason we decide to do a fixed payment. You say, we're gambling, basically. You say, you're going to pay me $100,000, and you've got occupancy of the house for the rest of your life. And I was thinking of a real French case. There was a woman not that long ago who died, who, I'm not sure if she was the oldest person in the world, but something close to that. She was like 110 or so. And it turned out that she had a house on those terms, and the owner of the house was rather unhappy about the fact that she'd gotten it for, you know, 20, 30 years longer than he expected, but as far as I know, legally, he had no recourse. Imagine that case. Let's suppose that I rent my house to you, and the deal, you're 85, and you give me a fixed payment, which represents our guess at an appropriate annual amount for the rest of your life. And then the next year, the breakthrough comes. Should I be able to back out of that contract?
So, isn't there a case out there already where there was a cow and one party was gambling on the cow's fertility and was thinking, like, I'm pretty sure this cow is a chance.
Rose or something?
Yes, the rose cow. And the rose cow turned out to be able to knock food still. And the person who was selling away the cow thought that the cow was barren, so he was willing to make that profit off the guy who thought he was. It was like they both went into it with their ulterior motives.
Yes.
But they both knew what they were risking, and so because there was that mutual risk, and neither of them actually confirmed whether the cow was or was not barren, I believe that the. That case actually went for the guy who sold the cow off. But it seemed like it was sort of an ambiguous issue because if you have that bad intent going into a contract.
But in this case, there's no bad intent. In the case I'm describing, which I think he's imagining when he put the question, both of them assume that the person who's 85 will be dead within 10 or 15 years. But then the world changes around them and suddenly it's not true.
I actually think that the case she's talking about, they were sitting in the contract.
Yes, that both of them thought it was barren, I think. But can anybody think of any cases of anything that I'm actually facing something like this, although I don't know what the legal status is, because my first book is in its second edition, and my contract, this was a book which was published about 1971, long, long time ago, and I suppose the contract for the second edition was sometime in the 80s, probably. And the contract specifies that if they let it go out of print for 9 months, the copyright reverts to me. And I would like to do a third edition. And it's not clear I can persuade them to do a third edition, so I'd like to have the copyright back. It turns out, I checked online using the Wayback Machine, which is an archive of web pages, so you can see what the web looked like a year or 5 years or whatever ago, that for a period of about 3 years, their web page listed the book as available. But it said available in 6 to 8 weeks. And somebody commenting on my blog said he got one, and it was explicitly a print-on-demand copy, not the same quality and appearance as the regular published copy. Well, that's technology that presumably didn't exist when we signed the contract. Does that define keeping it in print? Because in principle, given a print-on-demand technology, a publisher could keep a book legally in print forever, by simply saying, well, print another copy if somebody orders it, and yet as a practical matter, it would not be print. I knew that the book was not available on Amazon for example, for a long time, because I was checking. You were rather available on Amazon, only from third parties at very high prices, $100 or so for what should have been a $20 or $18 book. So I don't really know. My agent thinks that we could probably get the copyright back. I'm not all that eager to engage in litigation. But it just struck me that it's a closely analogous case to this one. And that it really is an issue that would come with a lot of technological changes of whether, you know, suppose global warming happens and suppose some piece of land ends up either much better or much worse than it was before the climate change, does that affect terms for long-term leases? All right. My guess is not. My guess is that would be within the normal uncertainty. But, you know, I rent you 10 square miles of desert. And to the astonishment of both of us, the desert blooms because global warming has resulted in more rainfall where that particular desert happens to be. Do I get to renegotiate the lease, or am I just lost in that I've rented you fertile land at, you know, 10 cents an acre or whatever? Are there any examples that anybody can think of?
Yeah. It may be analogous. There's a, you know, in property law, they've had to deal with where, you know, the border of land is a river. And
yes.
The river changes course.
Right.
It matters whether it changes, you know, abruptly by some, you know, storm or something, or by slow accretion over time.
Yes.
So, you know, I don't know if that could be...
Is there a legal rule?
If it's accretion, like sudden buildup, then I think you lose, you concede the property. But if it's like a sudden shift, then the boundary stays the same.
The case I know is the Stack Island case, if you know that. And that's this wonderful case where a river floats down the Mississippi, where an island floats down the Mississippi River. You have an island. And it's eroding at the upstream end and depositing at the bottom stream end, so it's gradually moving. And the island belongs to somebody. And the tract of land on the west bank of the Mississippi, just below the island, includes ownership of all islands in that strip of the Mississippi. And the island gradually floats into that area, and then the question is who owns it. And I think that the court ends up deciding it on grounds of adverse possession, and one side or the other hadn't asserted its claim, which is really a wimpy way of deciding, because it's really an interesting case. And it strikes me as sort of a point about one of the problems with property rules is that we tend to assume that it's easy to define our boundaries. And if you think about intellectual property, one of the real problems with the patent system is that ideas don't have sharply defined boundaries. So sort of the Stack Island is the exception for property and land, but in a certain sense in which it's the normal case for property and ideas, because, you know, here's this idea, well, here's this related, it's slightly more related, and so forth. Where is it? I'd like to point out that Morris attempted to patent the Internet. You did know that. You. Samuel Morse, when he applied for his patent on the telegraph, included as the last of his claims, he had a bunch of different claims, and the last claim was all methods of using the electromagnetic force to transmit letters or symbols to a distance. That covers the Internet. Of course, that would have expired by the time it mattered, but it nicely illustrates the problem of what had he invented. He had invented, he would claim, one example of all means of doing that. The court did not accept that. That was overbroad, but it is a real problem. All right, I don't know. If any of you come across any real examples, I'm sort of curious, because it's an issue that could apply across lots of the subjects of this course as to, you know, how do privacy rules apply if the technology, how do restrictions on searches, all right, that's one of the issues that's coming up. If we have some rule defining what a police search is, how does it change if they have technology that sees through walls? How does it change if they can wiretap your house from a distance by bouncing a light beam off your window and picking up the vibrations of the window? Think of all sorts of things. There was, of course, the question of whether you can tell whether a house is producing marijuana by using infrared to measure how hot the house is. And that, I think the court decided it was a search and so violated the Fourth Amendment. But anyway, so. But it just seems to be an interesting general question. So if you come across any case where you have a contract or a legal rule which has an unambiguous... Oh, we've got a case, of course. We've already talked about a case. The definition of parenthood, Lord Mansfield's rule. Unambiguous rule which is that the mother of a child is the woman from whose body the child was born, and the father of the child is the husband of that woman, assuming she was married and cohabiting when the child was conceived. That, I think, was unambiguous California law 20 years ago. And then we have the case that I mentioned in the book of the child with five parents, where that rule gave a straightforward answer. It was the host mother who was the mother, and her husband, if she was married, who was the father, and the court just ignored it and chose a much more sensible rule. So I guess that would be one example where it did happen. I don't know what any contrary. All right, if you can think of any more. Our absent DE has another one. As a general rule, for works created after January 1st, 1978, copyright protection lasts for the life of the author plus an additional 70 years. Would this become unconstitutional as a violation of the copyright clause's limited times requirement if it becomes possible to extend one's life indefinitely? Do people know about the real Supreme Court case related to this? There was a case, Larry Lessig was one of the people involved with it, for some reason I know about it, where the Copyright Extension Act, it was being argued was unconstitutional. And the basic argument was, as some people put it, that any time Mickey Mouse is about to go out of copyright, the Copyright Act gets extended. So the argument they were making is that although each individual extension left it with a limited time, the fact that it was then getting extended again and again meant that it was really an unlimited time and therefore in violation of the clause. They lost before the Supreme Court, which was not surprising. But it was, in a sense, a related issue. So do people have an opinion? Suppose we say that the law says life plus 70 years. Can you sue to cancel my copyright? After I should have died plus 70 years, had there not been life extension or not? Opinions? Yep.
I think you have to change the law just because 70 years maybe a nominal life jump for everyone. That's a nominal life jump.
That's what you want to do, but what's the legal consequence? If Congress doesn't change the law, can you go to the Supreme Court and say the law is presently written as unconstitutional, so therefore it has to be modified in some fashion?
I think he's right. I mean, it wouldn't be considered unconstitutional because the Constitution requires that it was not only that comment, but suggesting that the term.
It says limited term.
For times, right?
What?
For a certain time.
For a certain amount of time. If a person's not dying, then that technically is.
But the counter argument that I would make as a copyright holder is that the old rule, it was limited but indefinite. You didn't know how long somebody was going to live. Well, the new rule is limited but indefinite. The sun's going to burn out eventually, and we'll die of cold, and even before that, even if I'm not getting old each year, there's one chance in 10,000 that I'll be run over by a truck. There's one chance in 50,000 that lightning will strike me. I mean, if I walk in dangerous areas, I've got whatever the current rate is, 4 in 100,000 chances of being murdered. My argument would be it's still limited term, which you don't know how long, it's got a little bit longer than it used to be. Yep.
So you could argue the policy implication of the founders who wrote it, and what was the intended purpose of it, and it was a barter between the society and the individual, and you're really destroying that barter.
Except that since they have changed the term repeatedly over the last 200 years, the counter-argument would be that, yes, it was a barter, but the terms weren't specified. The terms were freedom for Congress to set. After all, the Constitution doesn't say what the terms are going to be. So it's still a limited term. It's just a very long limited term. Anyway, that was an interesting question. I liked it. Next one we have is L.Y. And I don't remember anymore who is L.Y.
L.Y. in the room.
Yes, that's now L.Y. It's your L.Y. isn't it, right? Yeah. Got it. So why don't you read it?
So, well, age in the private institution, you have to say ID to show your actual age on the front. Yeah, if like Asian, you can just pick one or 18 or 2. And that is the value required. Security ID to show your actual age.
Well, are you now?
Not necessarily.
Why would you need our... Yes? Sorry, were you raising your hand? No. Why would you need to prove your age?
For example, if you make yourself look like you're 18,
yeah.
or 17 or 16.
Okay. So you make yourself look like 16. Note that there are two different versions, as it were, of life extension. The modest version, all you can do is to stop aging. The radical version, you can set your body to the apparent age you like. So let's take the radical version, which I think where yours is going to be. Right. And also going the other way, even with the modest version, you can have somebody who at 12 decides to stop getting old, and so he's really 40 but looks like 12. So I guess the issue can even arise with the less optimistic version. So what is the reason you need your ID? Why do you have to prove your age? I'm not required, walking down the street, I'm not required to prove my age. Or carry ID in the U.S. even. If I'm driving, right, so if I'm going to drive a car, and if the legal rule is you have to be a certain age, but if I'm driving, I have to have a driver's license. And they won't give me a driver's license without my establishing my age. What about other things? Buy alcohol, vote. So there will be a variety of things for which you'll have to prove your age. But there are things for which, in principle, you have to prove your age now. It's just that a lot of them one doesn't bother because it's considered obvious. What about turning to the other side, namely the privacy issue? Suppose I say I want to keep my age secret. Suppose I say I'm a film star, I play 19-year-olds, and I won't do as good a job of having all of the fans fall in love with me if they realize I'm really 97. Do I have any legal right to keep that information secret? Yes?
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Is the information in a driver's license public information?
I don't know. Good question.
Because if that is, then I would say...
But of course, it doesn't have to have age. You might... Suppose we decided, oddly enough, that it was really important that you be able to keep your age secret. We might then say that to get the driver's license, you have to show evidence of age, but the driver's license just says you have a driver's license, it doesn't say your age. It's not clear to me you would care. If you could imagine, you can certainly imagine circumstances. Suppose, for example, that the initial anti-aging treatment is very experimental and they're afraid maybe it does kill some people, and so you end up 40 years after it exists with a very small cohort of people who are 130 or 120 and look 70, and only beginning to become common for everybody else, and those people are being discriminated against. All right? You could imagine circumstances in which it's considered appropriate to try to keep it secret.
Yep. So we could possibly change the requirement of whatever information is required. So for voting, you just need to verify that you are above 20 or something, right? So once you cross that limit, you get that verified, you might have under your weed or your license or required part of this, that you at least cross 20 years old.
Yes, and right. Yeah, well, that is mechanically the problem is just that it's very hard to hide information. People are going to Google and see whether you were around 50 years ago. But you can always say it was my father who had the same name or something like that.
I just found the example you just gave. It's like a recent sort of case where some actress is suing IMDb for being
paid. Ah, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
She thinks that she is, and she's like, well, now that people know my real age, I'm going to get hired. They dropped the case, though, because she filed everything down in the law, so you have to have main parties, and so it was, just trying to be anonymous.
Right.
So I don't know if that actually came to position, but it's been brought up for the entertainment industry. Because she thinks she has the right to practice her age, but then they're like, well, that's fraud.
Yes.
So it's sort of
something. Yeah, that's interesting. So it really has.
Yeah,
it is at least possible to sue, whether or not it's possible to win.
Right.
On that. Yeah. But it could be a much bigger issue if the 17. Suppose what you're really specializing in is playing 15-year-olds and having all of the 14-year-olds in love with you, kind of thing. Or imagine that kind of, or maybe you're a rock star or something doing that kind of thing. You might really want to not people to have people not realize that you're really much older than that. All right, let's see. The next one is RP, I think, right?
Gene sequences are currently patentable, and so something like telomerase is built as a mechanism by which people are able to extend life that could potentially have the ability to create or use lifelong sequence to whoever is able to precisely like these genes. And my question was, is this okay? Is this important in order to have the lifelong sequence to manage different results? And I said, under current law, probably not. This is obviously tie cancer research to particular gene sequence, and obviously there isn't even a problem under U.S. law.
But also, presumably under U.S. law, if I am the only maker of a drug that's critical to keeping people with some disease alive, I'm still allowed to patent it, right?
If something like cancer, which saves a lot of lives, people don't have to deal with a problem with it. I don't see why they would have a big problem with the absence of freedom of life one.
Yeah, but of course, there is the problem with all of this that even if U.S. law protects it, other countries may say it's so important to us that unless you agree to license it to us at a very low price, we'll just violate your... I mean, that's one of the problems, in a sense, with the whole medical patent system, is that since patents are at the national level, there's really no way of compelling another country... To respect them.
At least in the case of like pharmaceuticals,
and yeah.
They just produce generics at low cost.
Yeah. And presumably, though I don't know for sure, I assume that one reason why pharmaceuticals are cheaper in some other countries is that the industry believes that unless they give them a deal, they will decide to start pirating.
Yeah, exactly.
That's an implied threat in a good deal of it. Let's see. You have the next one as well.
So following this line of questioning, I was wondering if there should be some sort of exception holding the law related to life, just like there was for internet. So internet exception was basically, I wouldn't say it was a doctrine, but allowed the internet to grow rapidly by giving them protection from standard communications laws and stuff like jurisdiction. So originally they didn't know how to decide personal jurisdiction for the internet stuff.
What is a Zippo test? I don't know it.
They had like three factors, like level of involvement, how interactive the site was, something like that, which allowed you to establish jurisdiction for an internet site that's really nowhere in a specific location.
Mm-hmm.
And of course they have EMCA, safe harbor stuff. So web extension creates so many problems, like for example, if you could set yourself at a standard age, like say you make your body like 14 when in reality you're 98, how does that affect stuff like drinking or statutory rape or voting, stuff like that? So it might just make more sense to have sort of a separate sort of law, just like more category, more classifications for people who use those treatments as opposed to people doing just to avoid the hassle.
I was thinking about the statutory rape case. What's the present status of child pornography made without using children? Is or isn't covered as child pornography?
It's legal.
It's legal. Right. So if you do cartoon or if you use actors who look very young but are really above age and so forth. I was just thinking that it's analogous in a sense whether what's illegal is the actual age or the apparent age, because you could certainly see people saying, well, our objection to that, there are in a sense two different objections to statutory rape. One of them is that somebody that young isn't informed enough to give informed consent. Another is that it feels icky. And the feels icky thing might apply if, you know, the partner looked 11 even though she was really 73 or something, whereas the other one wouldn't. And I don't know which would dominate, because people do let their feels icky feelings affect the law in lots of different contexts. But,
especially since, because in a sort of situation, there would be sort of different ages you can have, like physically your body, you could say your age at one
yes.
point, your body's skeleton, presumably would be at that 14-year-old age
yes.
or whatever, even though you're I guess, mental view much higher.
Yep.
So, you know, a lot of the things that you don't let humans do are protected from, so that's not really concerning.
And of course, a further issue in a sense, which we haven't really thought about much, is whether keeping your body at a different age will affect your mind. That is, I sort of assume that if I have a 19-year-old body, my mind will be different in the sense that I will have what we think of as sort of the hormonal urges, that I will feel a lot more lustful than I do in my 60s, and there will be other changes of that sort, and maybe more impulsive. That, you know, I assume everybody realizes that human males go crazy at about age 16 and recover about age 26. And the evidence for that is auto insurance rates, or crime rates, or who volunteers for the army. And I think there are plausible evolutionary biology explanations for the pattern. But it may well be that if you're a perfectly sane, cool 50-year-old and they turn your body back to 17, suddenly you'll be driving fast and, you know, feeling like you want to get into fights with people and doing all sorts of crazy things of the sort that male adolescents do. I don't think there is a comparably clear pattern for females, but I'm not sure. Not having a good one. But anyway, so that's sort of an interesting... interesting. Do people have thoughts about that? Or is it clear that you would want sort of special legal regime, new set of law if we have life extension? What are the new laws you want? One of them we've already had suggested, namely copyright. Once life extension comes in, we now want to make copyright for a fixed number of years instead of life plus 70 years. That's the argument anyway. Now, of course, you could argue. I'm going to argue the other side, being a copyright holder. My argument is the reason for life plus 70 years is that life is obvious because that means I'm getting the return for my intellectual effort. That's surely just. Now, you can say if it was forever, that return would be going to distant descendants who I know nothing about. But 70 years is about right for saying that's the point at which my grandchildren or great-grandchildren start dying. I knew them as little kids, and I love them dearly, and I want them to get the income from my copyrights. So that's my argument for life plus 70 years. But anyway, that would be one case, though, where your argument might apply. And where else? Suppose you win this. Suppose we agree that life extension has really made things different. What laws do you propose? You're in Congress now. So the Life Extension Adjustment Act, what laws do you propose? We've already thrown out mandatory retirement.
I would say voting and drinking for sure.
How do you change it? Why don't you just keep the same rule? Why do you just because I've got a 15-year-old body? Why shouldn't I be allowed to vote and drink? After all, I'm 50 or whatever I am. What are the places where you would want to change the law once you've got life extension, other than the copyright argument? Anybody else have any? Yeah.
Seems like healthcare. I can't quite put my finger on it, but if you're living that long, that the potential burden on people if you're getting free healthcare for that long just seems a little bit ridiculous. And
there could be the counter argument which says, look, the really expensive thing about health care is old people. There aren't going to be any more old people, so wonderful health. We finally solved the health care problem, right? There's one which occurs to me, going back to what I was saying a moment ago, is if you believe that people's behavior is partly affected by their biological rather than chronological age, you might say that if your biological age is below some level, now you don't get to vote or to drink because now, even though you've got the memories and the experience of an adult, you've got the emotions and the hormones or whatever it is, or the impulsiveness of an 11-year-old or 8-year-old or something, and maybe you would say, well, somebody that old, somebody with those. So that's one possibility, is that maybe some of the age requirements would go to physical age rather than chronological age. Yep.
Probably change the life sentences for prison.
Yeah, let's let that go, because that's one of the things that somebody else has a question on. But you're right that one of the issues that's going to arise is sentencing. So, all right. Well, if people think of a good idea, tell us, because it just struck me as an interesting issue. You've got another one.
So why is sentencing not in existence, and presumably no cares exists or no difference to others? Should the government mandate the life extension treatments for other basic forms of insurance, like emergency care or...
But it isn't insurance at all. It may or may not be a good idea, but it's not insurance. Birth control isn't insurance either. That is to say, one of the things that struck me about this whole flap over what's your name is what she's... They're calling it insurance.
Right.
But insurance is a matter of low probability, high cost things that you're trading for high probability, low cost things. It's a gamble. There's no gamble involved in her use of contraception. She is quite confident that she's going to need to pay for it, you know, on a regular basis. And in this case, aside from the few people who don't want to live a long time, so it really seems to me that thinking of insurance confuses things, and it's more nearly the question of should the government in effect subsidize? Should we say that one of the things taxes will pay for is to provide everybody with life extension?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that doesn't really change the fundamental question, which is that does it help to prevent class stratification? And what I thought was that as you grow older, to accumulate wealth and power because you make increasingly informed decisions. You get a greater base of experience. So if you could live even forever for a substantially long time, the people who can afford it, those families would show increasingly wealthier.
But isn't it going to depend a lot on you? There's a science fiction story where there's a guy who is, I don't know, 20,000 years old. He basically was a caveman who had some biological accident has been around ever since, and someone has, you know, finally spotted what he is, so to speak, and is talking with him and says, well, look, you know, living that long, you could have invested, you know, money 500 years ago and be really rich. And he says, people like me, you don't save money. You got money, you get drunk. I don't know what he said, but something like that. So his point is that depends on the willingness to sacrifice short-term for long-term benefits, which some people will do and some people won't do. Now, you might argue that the very existence of life extension is going to increase divisions, even if everybody has it, on the grounds that those people who are sort of future-oriented are going to get higher and higher relative to those people who live day-to-day for a much, much longer period of time. So that sort of is an interesting thought that hadn't occurred to me, but that comes out of it. Beyond that, do you think preventing class division is an appropriate government function?
I guess it depends on
what you're doing with government. Yeah. Because one of the underlying questions here, which sort of may go farther than we want it to go tonight, is why should government be involved with medical things at all? And if people are curious about my views on the subject, I actually have a old article webbed on my webpage called Should Medical Care Be a Commodity? And in that one, I'm trying to argue whether persuasively you'd have to decide for yourself that really medical care is no different than anything else people value, and that the general assumption that it should get special treatment isn't really defensible. I'm not sure if I'm right, but I think it's at least an argument that ought to be made, because like many of these things, everybody takes something for granted without ever really thinking it through. And there's sort of this gut-level feeling that it's different. But it's not all that different, that after all, whether your car has airbags affects whether you live, and whether you have a job where you've got to go out in bad weather, even if you're not feeling very well, affects whether you're going to live. And so, anyway. But then the question is, are there good reasons why government should specifically subsidize this? So make it an explicit proposal, forget about calling it insurance, the government will provide free life extension to everybody in this country. Good or bad idea? Once we've got the technology.
It sounds like a terrible idea to me to just have everybody living forever and potentially reproducing at the same time, and I realize that you discussed that.
Yes, they can do that anyway if it's not too expensive. That is, it's only an interesting question if life extension is expensive, I think. If it's cheap, then whether you subsidize it or not, almost everybody's going to have it. So suppose that life expectancy, that the treatment costs $30,000. All right, that's a price at which everybody sort of middle class and above can afford it, but a fair number of people in the bottom 10 or 20% of the income distribution aren't going to afford it. Maybe if they really care, they will be able to. They'll be able to save up that money, but many of them won't. So assume that it's that kind of cost. Now, you're arguing against because you're afraid of population problems.
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting question. No, but doesn't mean, there's no rule in this class that you have to agree with me.
Yeah.
That would make life very boring. So that's one question. And other are there other reasons for or against?
I think the wrongful death is part of your reward is based on how much they would have earned over their lifetime. Correct. So, I mean, quantitatively, at least you've got this expectation for a rich person or somebody who's getting less attention treatment. Mm-hmm. That's more valuable life than a poor person or somebody who isn't getting
good. That's true under current law, right? That's right. But it's also magnified by changes that result in skilled people making more money. The weird thing about wrongful death, this is really a digression, is that the implicit assumption of current law and of traditional common law is that your life is worthless to yourself. All right? And that if you, in a tort suit for wrongful death, other people get to collect the value of your life to them. But suppose there are no other people who depend on you. As I understand current state laws for wrongful death, there is no claim. That it would seem sort of standard economic arguments of saying that the tort law is supposed to impose on actors the cost of their action, you ought to say, well, how much is being alive worth to you? As evidenced by what you would be willing to pay for medical treatments that made you less likely to die or a safer car or whatever, and the person who's wrongfully killed you ought to owe that amount to your estate. But in fact, they don't. Under traditional common law, they owed nothing to anybody because your claim died with you. And it was only wrongful death statutes that changed that, which basically said, yes, but your wife's claim for your support doesn't die with you, and so forth. So that strikes me as, I like it, you may know, Judge Posner has had this, offered this conjecture a long, long time ago, that you can understand the common law as an economically efficient set of rules. And that's my favorite counterexample, because I don't think you can, I don't know if I've ever discussed it with him, but I don't think you could successfully defend the claim that treating the value of your life to yourself as zero makes any sense. All right. Let's see. You're the next one, too. I've clustered you here. So why don't you get that?
So if life extension turns out to be an all-or-nothing proposition, that is, once you get the treatment, you become effectively impervious to aging, does this necessitate a change in laws concerning euthanasia and suicide? And my thought was that since other than sickness, you wouldn't be dying from natural causes anymore. The only way out would be euthanasia or suicide. So as a matter of fact, have to be able to kill yourself or let someone else kill you when you're in a debilitated state.
But you're not
going to be
in a debilitated state.
Well, I mean, you can still be sick to the point where your life functions are really low.
Well, but life extension won't. That is, the argument is not that life extension makes you unable to be killed.
Right, but.
So if you're dying of cancer, you're going to still die of cancer, right?
Like, if you were in a vegetative coma, your cells are never going to age to the point where you die, you're still in a coma. So you just.
Right. I was thinking actually of sort of a less material case. I was thinking that there are, after all, people now who say, maybe some of you, I don't remember the discussion, they wouldn't choose. In fact, I'm pretty sure some of you said you wouldn't choose to live forever if you could, or to live for a very, very long time. So imagine you have somebody who says, well, yeah, I got the treatment because I didn't want to die at 85. I had another 50 years worth of things to do, but I'm now 150 and I'm tired of life. And it used to be, well, that's simple. Wait a little while and you'll drop dead. Now it doesn't happen anymore. So now you want to say there's a legitimate reason for people to want to commit suicide because they, from their standpoint, their life is over. And the problem with that is that if you're going to make that argument, doesn't that legitimate reason exist already? You know, think of somebody who is 65 and really depressed and he's tried everything and the people he loved are dead and the causes that matter to him have been defeated. And, you know, he's a complete failure, and he says, better to be dead. Isn't that the same argument?
No, absolutely, I think it is. But the difference between now and then, there'd just be outcry or address popular movement to support change in laws because there'd be a lot more people experiencing that situation.
Maybe. I don't know. That is, we don't know, and I haven't done the experiment, whether most people would keep wanting to live or not. But yeah.
I think that if you were the government and you were making that law, they might argue that you chose that fate for yourself, and that was kind of part of the quid pro quo for choosing extended life, is that if you get tired of living in it, you don't get to check out so easily.
But of course, his hypothetical is the only way of doing life extension works that way, and you could say, well, look, isn't it a better technology if we have the option of extending your life for only 50 years? Well, we do. First, you take the life extension treatment, and it comes with a cyanide pill, and you wait 50 years and take the pill. That way, we have a better life extension, one which only extends your life as long as you want.
Okay. I didn't think about that, but...
Yep. Yes. So, others? Yep.
One of the thoughts I had about it was that it might be more important if there's a few, like, sort of depends on afterlife. If you live forever, there's no real afterlife. So people believe in heaven or hell or karma.
Except you're not going to live forever. You're going to live for a very long time, but there are always risks of one sort or another. But yeah. You know, well, I mean, an interesting question. To what extent... An interesting question in general, which I wonder about, is how much expressed religious belief actually affects behavior. Because there's a certain sense in which you're tempted to say, well, look, if people really believe in an afterlife, why do they wear a seatbelt? You know, I can understand if you say, well, my kids need me. But what if your kids don't need you? That you would think in principle that there ought to be a lot of behavioral differences between people who do and don't believe in one of the standard religious views. And one of them is that you would think believing in it would make you less willing to commit sins, because you believe you'll be punished depending on the religion, but that's true of lots of religions. Another is it ought to make you less worried about dying. Are you familiar with the phrase, kill them all, God will know his own? It's probably not a true story, but it's a great story. There was a heresy called the Albigensian heresy in southern France in, I don't know, 13th century, somewhere around there. And there was a crusade against it, the Albigensian crusade, which was basically a lot of northern French nobles crusading against the southern French with the endorsement of the Pope. And the story, which I gather doesn't have very good historical evidence that it's true, is that at one point the crusaders take a city, and the leader of the crusaders turns to the papal legate, and he says, how are we to tell which of the people in this city are Albigensian heretics, and which ones are good Catholics who just happen to live here? And the answer is, kill them all, God will know his own. Well, that makes sense if you really seriously believe in the religion, because, you know, you kill them all, but good Catholics go to heaven, that's not a problem for them, and the Albigensians go to hell, that's just what you want to have to happen to them. You know, what's the problem? And yet people, it feels shocking. And I think there's some level at which very few people, I think, really believe in their religion to that depth, really treat it as it. The line Orwell uses somewhere, when he's responding to some poll that shows a large majority of the English believe in some feeling of divinity or something. And he says, yeah, I don't want to know that. I want to know how many people believe in heaven the way they believe in Australia. And I think it's a nice way of putting a distinction between, and some people surely do, right? But I suspect a much smaller number than the ones who would describe themselves as believers in one religion or another. Anyway, the...
Comment on that number. Life after is that the basic premise is that if a person owns their life, well, the person being in an afterlife also believes that life is actually a, not.
Belongs to God. That's right. So there are, depending on the religion, there will certainly be many religions which will say the reason you can't kill yourself is that that's violating God's will. And there's actually a pretty good Edna St. Vincent Millay poem on that subject where somebody has killed himself and he then, you know, goes to heaven, he wants a job to do, and God says, sorry, but you had the job and you gave it up. Your job was living your life. You know, you can sort of sit around and play a harp if you like. You can't do anything important anymore. It's not the way she puts it, but that's sort of the overall effect. So yeah, that. But even so, it's, even if you say that your life, I don't know. Certainly many religions object to suicide. I'm wondering to what extent, on the other hand, religions generally approve of martyrdom. So to some extent, dying, and I'm not sure to what extent if you said, I didn't spend the money on a safer car. Why didn't I? Well, there are important other things to do with the money, and if I die, I go to heaven. I've lived a good life, so why should I? I'm not sure whether a religion would say you're not doing your job, taking care of yourself or not.
Well, I mean, the assumption that if you die, go to heaven, there is no, I mean, at least in our opinion, there is no such assumption. You go based on your deeds. So you need the life to create those deeds to be able to go to heaven.
But what if you've done enough deeds?
There is no such thing.
But then at some point you've done deeds such that God lets you go to heaven, right?
Well, if you knew that...
I have to tell you an Islamic story about one of the very early caliphs, the fifth caliph, Muawiyah. That he is an old man, and the conqueror of Egypt comes to visit, and they're talking. And tell me how I pronounce it, because I don't speak Arabic.
Muawiyah.
Yep. And the caliph is saying, "What things still give us pleasure in my age? Women, I'm too old for. Fine cloth, I've had cloth so fine that rough and smooth are the same to me. Good foods, no. What still gives me pleasure? To eat cool in the summer, to drink cool in the summer, and hear my children and grandchildren playing around me. How is it with you?" And the conqueror of Egypt answers, "Enough land to feed the family and a little over for the market, that suffices." And as they're speaking, the servant of the caliph, who was a freedman, Wardan, comes in. And he also is an old man. And the caliph says to him, "And what is it that gives you pleasure in your age?" And Wardan answers, "I take pleasure in thinking that I may yet do some noble deed that will live in the memory of remembering men and earn after for me in paradise." And the prince of the Muslims turns to the conqueror of Egypt and says, "Enough of this talk. This slave is a better man than thou or I." Isn't that a wonderful little thing? Anyway, but it's relevant to your point as well. All right, let's see. The next one we have is I believe it's PH. I'm not seeing a PH on my list. What? All right. There you are, Patrick Hensley. That's right. I'm bad at memorizing names. It's fine.
If life extension exists, what impact might a world of both retired or semi-retired travelers have on the cultural makeup?
Mm-hmm.
What if people travel all over the world and take up residence wherever they happen to be? How might immigration policies change to accommodate long-lived nomads who may live in a place for a decade or two, then move on? Could these nomads vote? So I just couldn't help but notice that last week when we had the three options up on the board, everybody seemed to choose C, which was work for a while, then retire, invest until you run out of money, presumably, and then work again.
Or my preferred version is then only do work that's fun.
Right, and so presumably whatever that fun work would be, you're probably a wide variety that will take you to a lot of different places in the world. So you would assume that in a world where it's widely available, you have a lot of people doing this same thing.
Right.
So now you wonder what happens to cultures, and you would assume that some countries would probably have kind of protectionist laws that won't let people come in or necessarily leave or come back in if they leave indefinitely.
Yep.
They certainly couldn't vote. They probably couldn't even work. But then there are other countries that would probably welcome it. Maybe developing countries would be looking for white-collar workers.
Yep.
Certain countries.
And not just workers, tourists who will spend money.
Right. It's people that are willing to spend money. You would assume vacations would last longer as well when time doesn't really matter.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess it would last longer. As to the voting, I think that in a lot of countries, you would assume if you're taking up residence for 10 to 20 years, and this is just a very common thing, that they would permit you to vote, at least in some local election where...
Wouldn't most countries give you citizenship in 10 or 20 years under current rules?
You would think so, right? I mean, I know that in the U.S., it is how long is the actual process, but it does take 10 to
But the U.S. is also pretty skimpy on, I mean, for a country made up entirely of immigrants, we're very stingy about, yeah.
Just on the thing about whether they would, like, let people be citizens after 10 or 20 years, like, that's a pretty significant portion of our life now.
And it wouldn't be then.
And, you know, so we have invested, like, we care about the policies that are probably going to last more than 10 or 20 years.
Yes.
And if you're going to live forever, you're just going to move on.
One of the things that occurred to me was that maybe if you had in the future you're describing, maybe you get non-geographical nations. Have any of you read Diamond Age by Stephenson? Because I only read part of it, but it's a not too distant future world in which, as best I recall from the part I read, you have nations that are defined culturally rather than geographically. So that one of the nations is the Neo-Victorians, referred to as Vickies. And the Neo-Victorians are people who sort of believe in the Victorian virtues. They believe in getting married and staying married and working hard in sort of a bunch of somewhat old-fashioned but pretty functional and productive norms. And I think they've got a queen or a king. I don't remember what it is. There's at least a symbolic leader and some kind of structure. But they don't have a territory of their own. They're just people scattered around. And there are other such nations. I don't remember the other ones. That's what I have to remember. So you could imagine a future in which the set of emotions that we now associate with nationality went with some kind of, it could be religious, it could be political, it could be cultural, but some kind of a non. And of course you see lots of that nowadays on a low level. If you think about the fact that, as everybody around here knows, the great religious war of the 21st century is Windows versus Macintosh. All right, but it's a real phenomenon. There really is a sense, it's a weak sense compared to nationalism, but there really is a sense in which you sort of feel, my fellow Mac users, they're the good guys. And I've even observed it in myself as weakly as when I see another car which is the same model of car and the same color as mine. I sort of have a little bit of a feeling, all right, you know, that's a buddy kind of thing. And I shouldn't, it makes no sense. What? You wave at it. Yeah. But you could certainly imagine that if you, it's not the same thing as life extension, but it's a possible consequence. If you have a world where people are much more mobile, less tied to a particular community and location, they may still want to be tied to something. And so they may still develop allegiances, as it were, which aren't geographical, but which are like geographical ones.
But because what I was envisioning more generalized, almost world culture, which I
yes.
think also rise out of this, right? Where I don't know that you don't have
the
that.
The problem is, it's a problem that we've, I think, solved pretty well. Human beings want to matter. If your reference group is billions of people, or even 100, 300 billion people, you're sunk. There's no way you're going to be an important person. But if your reference group is your fellow enthusiast for Kipling's poetry, or the fellow members of your historical recreation group, which recreates, you know, Cretan history, or some relatively, if your reference group is only 50 or 100 or a few hundred people, like someone in a village 400 years ago, you could reasonably expect that if you live a decent, hardworking life, as you age, you will matter. People will know who you are. You're an important person. And I think if you look at modern day, a book that I wanted somebody to write is Little Worlds. Because I keep observing them. The little worlds are the subcultures within our society. That one of mine is medieval historical recreation. My wife's parents were mineral collectors. My sister and her husband are top-level bridge players. My sister also has horses. Each of those is a little world. Each of those, there are a bunch of people who know each other. That world has its own hierarchies. You can be, you know, a well-known person in that world or a novice. But if you put time and energy into your world, at least at the local level, you'll become a significant person, kind of thing. So in that sense, it seems to me that even if you have a world culture, you're going to also want to have a whole lot of subgroups defined somehow.
And I think that when you have the internet and everything like that also facilitates
right.
That's
right. Yes. Because you can keep your friends even though you happen to have moved to a different continent. Yes, no, I observe my kids are home for spring vacation at the moment, and my daughter
spent some hours, I think yesterday, on a role-playing game that she has once a week, and the friends are scattered around the country who are the other players in that game. And then she's got another one once a week, and the other players are in Chile. And so that's clearly one of the things that's happening. So yeah, I mean, it's a broader question than life extension, because the internet does it, higher real incomes can do it, but the question of what the world looks like as the national boundaries, even to take something much more modest. Let's just suppose that China and India end up with our standard of living, which is not at all unlikely 100 years from now. All right? Well, most Americans, sort of other than the sort of fairly low end of the distribution, can afford to visit Europe once in a while if they feel like it. How about a world where most of the world's population can afford to take their vacation anywhere else in the world they want? Be an interestingly different world. All right, let's go on to the next one. We're back with Linda, I think.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So, if the only one that retires,
Patrick asked the same question. You see, there are two questions with the same thing. Do you have comments to add to that?
I think the government at some point probably, whatever government exists, and I do kind of exist, they probably would have to step in and say, we need some...
Remember that under current discrimination law, it's not illegal to discriminate on relevant factors. Right, there's nothing illegal about discriminating against women if you're hiring sperm donors, to take the extreme case. Or even if you're hiring people to pick things up because men have more body strength, although there you ought to be willing to hire a woman who shows high body strength. So if people say, well, look, we're not discriminating against young people. We just prefer people who've got experience in the field. And if you are only 19, but you managed to sort of start in the field at 11 somehow, we'll give you just as much credit as if you're 80 and started at 72. It just happens that there aren't any young people who meet our requirements.
So you may just be looking at subsidies somewhere for companies willing to hire legitimate, whatever that I was calling them. So you're... may be creating entire industries that would hire like these legitimate youth so they could gain experience.
My point is only that it doesn't, I don't think discrimination law is the right category to think in terms of. But then one response to that is that there are two things wrong with the story both of you are telling. First, you may be willing to hire the less skilled person just at a lower wage, as long as the person's productivity is positive. I'm reminded, I have a very short list of economics jokes. An economics joke, to me, is a joke that makes an economic point. And one of the less distinguished, but not bad one of them, I got out of a Middle Eastern cookbook by Claudia Rodin. And the question is, what is sweeter than honey? And the answer is free vinegar. All right, that is to say that for some purposes, what matters is not absolute quality, but ratio of quality to cost. And so you could certainly imagine that our firm has lots of jobs for young people. They don't pay very well. They're, you know, assistants and helpers out and gophers. You know, you go for doing this. And some of them work out. So that's one answer. A very different answer is that there is some reason to think that the young people may be more qualified. That I remember this discussion with my father a long time ago. There's a good deal of evidence in fields like mathematics and some scientific field that people make their important contributions early. That great mathematicians do their great mathematics sort of before the age of 30 and then more or less retire and teach and do other things. So in that case, my father's idea was that it would be an interesting experiment to get somebody who had been really productive in such a field, and when he stopped being productive, retrain him into another field. Because the question is it that young people are productive? Or is it the people who are new to the field and therefore haven't already internalized all the answers, some of them wrong, that everybody else has, are different? I told him that he should have no trouble at all getting funding for that project, given how unpopular his views in his field were with some people. But he didn't take me up on that idea. But you would think that... So anyway, so it's possible that at least in some areas that being young may be a real virtue, that we may say that, you know, people who are really young, not just look young, have new ideas there, and so forth.
You may even think that with people within an industry, it's very unlikely that you will have somebody throughout their whole extended life will stay in one career.
Right.
Not completely by choice, because you would think that as you, like, when you put it out, like, young people, they're cheaper.
Right.
There's going to be a point where after you have 80 years of experience, you are so expensive that you are no longer worth that cost.
And you're so rich that you're only willing to work for a high wage or a really nice job. So you could certainly imagine a case where the old people, who if they're any good, can retire if they want to, take the nice fun jobs, and the young people work their way up for the first 30 years by taking whichever jobs are boring or unexciting or unpleasant or whatever. Jobs that you find. It's sort of like, I mean, the argument at least is made, I don't know how good the evidence with regard to immigration, that when people say, look, immigrants take jobs away from Americans, and one answer is no, they take jobs Americans wouldn't do. And that's at least a possible story, and you can imagine that story in this context as well, I think, yeah. One thing on the next section. Lots of people are using cryogenic when they meet cryonic. Cryogenics is the physics of low temperatures, whereas cryonic suspension is keeping people from permanently dying by cooling them down a whole lot. So I make that mistake too sometimes. So, and I think we've decided that there is no DE. DE is a figment of our imagination. So I'm going to have to ask this one. Imagine cryonics is advanced enough that we can safely freeze and revive a person with no adverse effects to the body. If a state determines that it is less costly to freeze its inmate from the housing in prison, should it be able to? Should a prisoner be allowed to serve out his term while frozen? Reactions?
Well, just from one standpoint, if one of your goals of the prison system is to rehabilitate them, if they're just frozen, then they're unthawed.
I think that's the right way place to start, not in terms of that particular goal, but say, what is the goal? Why are you imprisoning people?
Right.
If it's to rehabilitate them, which I think is implausible, but it's certainly a desirable goal if you can do it, then it doesn't work. If it's to deter them, it doesn't work either, because, you know, they're taking a break from life and come back in 20 years, and, you know, so that doesn't work either. If it's to incapacitate them, that is, you could argue for long sentences that the idea is by the time this guy is 70, he's not going to be going around mugging people anymore, so we can let him out safely. But if you think of the function of the prison is to keep him away from other people he might injure, it doesn't work because he'll get out at 30. So I'm finding it a little hard to think of a plausible story in which freezing for that purpose makes sense. And the only one I could think of is if for some reason his crime is one which is going to become unworkable over time. If you know, he was a cattle rustler and not going to be any cattle to be rustled or something like that, which seems sort of a rather special and odd case. So that didn't seem too convincing.
Maybe there's a certain danger too that if it becomes an economic decision and this thing goes well, it's a person's on, you know, life support and they're in a prison hospital and costing us X number of dollars per day. It's just cheaper to freeze them. Okay, yep. Let's do that.
Another concern you might be worried about is if once they're frozen it's cheap, there's going to be a temptation to say, well, we don't need them around. I mean, let's give all 300-year sentences. And then renew them when you know, we don't really want to dump all those 300-year-old criminals in our society again. So there is the argument, which I've got one article on, that it's dangerous for punishment to be too cheap. Because it's never cheap for the guy who's punished, and other people may ignore his cost if there are no costs to them. This is my article on the inefficiency of efficient punishments, where I'm arguing that you want to apply the economic approach to the enforcement apparatus as well as to the criminals and think about their incentives, and that you have to worry a bit if it's too cheap and easy to punish people that you may do it too readily. Under what conditions should a state be permitted to revive a person frozen before death? For example, if a fugitive is finally found but is cryonically frozen, should the government be permitted to thaw the body? If so, for what type of offenses? What if it's civil matter? It also occurred to me to think about the case where the technology isn't fully developed. So if we thaw him now, he's a 15% chance of dying, but we figure if we wait another 20 years, he's going to be safe. Are we entitled to thaw him anyway on the grounds that, you know, the court wants him? He's been convicted of something, we want to start punishing him, or do we say we have to hold him until? Any reactions, any thoughts on these?
Maybe one issue would be like how ending the, like, you know, if it was like a serial killer on the loose, he thought someone else, like other people were going to get killed if he didn't find out who the killer was, and this guy might be a suspect, he would call him out. If he turned out to be the suspect, you could imprison him. If he wasn't the suspect, or if he was missing, you're going to...
Are you obligated to freeze him again?
You're probably entitled to some type of retribution.
That's interesting. Let's think about a much milder case of the same sort. Suppose you want me as a witness in a law case, and I happen to be in Europe at the moment, and you subpoena me. Are you required to pay my transportation to and from the court back to where I was?
I don't know if we even have jurisdiction on you.
Fine, I'm not in Europe, I'm in Alaska or Hawaii, someplace far away but within U.S. law. So the question is, if in order to get my testimony there is a cost, namely my transport back and forth, are you entitled to impose that cost on me? I've done nothing wrong, I'm just a witness.
I don't know.
Yeah, neither do I. Because I was just thinking about the question of you've thawed me and I've testified, and no, I'm not the guy you want. And I say, and by the way, do you mind refreezing me? It's going to cost quite a lot of money, and I don't see why I should have to do it twice, and I don't know if I win or not.
Well, if you're talking about, like, a lay witness, that would be one thing. The expert witnesses, you have to pay them.
Sure.
So, I don't know.
But the expert witness, you're contracting with him, whereas you can't contract with a guy who's frozen until afterwards. Even with advances in DNA and other types of evidence, undoubtedly many are still wrongfully executed. Could a state adopt a position that instead of executing people via lethal injection and the like, it would instead going to freeze people so that there is at least the possibility that a wrongfully convicted person could someday be revived? What arguments could one make that execution is preferable? This is very close to a Larry Niven science fiction story. In the science fiction story, I think they still have execution, and you're just frozen during the appeals, essentially. The idea is that rather than put everybody through this harrowing business of you've been condemned to death, but maybe they'll save you, you're condemned to death, they freeze you, and if the appeal acquits you, they wake you up, and if not, you never wake up. And the story is called The Patchwork Girl. And it's a story in which you have a strikingly beautiful woman who is falsely convicted of a murder and frozen. This is on the moon. And during the relevant period, people manage to prove that she's entirely innocent. And they thaw her out. And it turns out that while she was frozen, there was an organ shortage due to an accident of some sort. And illegally, on the assumption that she was not going to ever be thawed out, various bits and pieces of her were used to patch up other people. And they now put her back together with bits and pieces, and this beautiful, was very strikingly beautiful woman is now the patchwork girl. So it's sort of an interesting story. Niven has explored a number of these things before. But what would you might you worry about, putting that aside? Suppose we do this. Can you think of any argument against assuming that keeping the frozen isn't too expensive?
There's a lot of basis on, but when people are up for the death penalty, there's a lot of sentiment that they should suffer the same consequence that they caused. And cryonic suspension isn't, in some sense, if they can revive you.
But if they never do revive you?
If they never, I think it's the fact that the possibility exists.
Uh-huh.
And so it's not true death.
So you think the retributive motive is going to argue against it?
Yeah.
Any other arguments? And the obvious argument for it is you get to correct your mistakes, but you probably very rarely do, but you might occasionally, yeah.
The cool and unusual idea that they're not really sure what's going on with your mind, if you're just sitting there.
Yes, so this assumes that you really are unconscious and we don't know that. Right. Yeah. The thing which bothers me a little bit, again, going back to my point about cost, is that it might be too easy. That you could imagine people saying, well, we're not really sure he's guilty, but we think he's guilty. And rather than go through all of this business of deciding, frees him, and after all, somebody else could figure out later that we were wrong and let him out, and then nobody ever does, because once he's frozen, it's no longer an issue. So I could at least imagine it becoming too easy to do for that reason. There's one possibility. Alright, I think we're out of time, and the last couple of questions aren't that interesting anyway, so... See you all in a couple of days. All right, second to the last one. Right, when do you get paralegally dead? Maybe.